I'm Tom Hall. This is an archive edition of Midday. Today we revisit a conversation I had last March with Washington Post reporter Wesley Lowery. He's one of the Post's national reporters who covers race, politics, justice, and law enforcement. His latest book is called They Can't Kill Us All: Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. As the horrific violence in Charlottesville last week demonstrated, white nationalists, neo-Nazis, Ku Klux Klan members, and white supremacists are coming out of the shadows and increasing their profile. People of color must contend with this unsheathed hatred, while distrust and a long history of abusive behavior by some in law enforcement still hangs in the air. How has civil rights activism changed in this toxic climate? This is a rebroadcast, so we can't take your calls today. First, the news. Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to a special edition of Midday. Today, a conversation with a reporter who covered the police shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, and subsequently traveled around the country bringing to light the all too frequently repeated stories of African Americans who have died at the hands of police. Wesley Lowery is a national reporter who covers law enforcement and justice for The Washington Post. His trip to Ferguson in the summer of 2014 was the first of many journeys he made across America to communities who rose up in protest in the face of police violence. Those trips included, of course, stops in Baltimore to cover the death of Freddie Gray and the uprising that coursed through the city on the day of Freddie Gray's funeral. Wesley Lowery has collected his observations about police violence in a compelling book that ties together several threads that run through this series of assiduously reported accounts of the stories behind the stories of the young, mostly men, who died. Their names are familiar: Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Philando Castile, Walter Scott, Alton Sterling. What perhaps isn't so familiar is an understanding of the culture in law enforcement and the legacy of unconstitutional treatment of African Americans that for years has plagued communities of color in cities large and small. As Lowery reports, in the year following Michael Brown's death in Ferguson, an unarmed black person was killed in America every 10 days. Until Lowery and his colleagues at the Post created it, there was no comprehensive database of police shootings. Lowery's book is called They Can't Kill Us All: Ferguson, Baltimore, and the New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. He joins us from the newsroom of The Washington Post. Mr. Lowery, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we are not taking any calls today on this Midday special edition because we are taping our conversation, but you can comment on our discussion on the WIPR Facebook page. So let's talk first about Fatal Force, which is the database that you and colleagues at the Post created to keep track of people who are killed when police are in the line of duty. How did that come about? Why did you want to do it? And what kind of information are you collecting?
Of course. Now, that project, which is ongoing, we're still running our database, we're still publishing it in real time, sought to answer one of the questions that was raised by the protests and by the anger in Ferguson and then eventually elsewhere. You know, I remember being on the ground covering those stories, writing these articles. I would, you know, spend a day interviewing residents, interviewing activists, interviewing people who were in the streets. And what so often they would say is that this is a crisis, that unarmed black men are being executed every day in the streets. Now, being a reporter, I would call the police, call the police chief, call the police union, and we would say, you know, what do you guys think of these police shootings? And what the police would say is, oh, no, we definitely are not executing unarmed black people in the streets every day. Most officers never pull their guns and never fire them. Police shootings are rare. They never happen. And when they happen, they're definitely not unarmed black men. So I'd write my stories up, and I would send them to an editor. And the editor would say, well, which of these things is true? Either the police are executing unarmed black people in the streets every day, or police shootings are rare and never happen, and the police are not executing unarmed black people in the streets every day. We sought to find the answer to that question. You know, that began with us calling the usual suspects. We called the Missouri Secretary of State. We would call the Department of Justice. And we were asking them, what statistics, what information do you have about police shootings? What we quickly found was that these places did not have comprehensive statistics. That was kind of shocking to us. You know, we thought that we would walk into the Department of Justice and there would be a file cabinet and little manila envelopes for every single police shooting, right? Of course they would have records on this. We're a country that measures everything. We know how many shark attacks there have been in Los Angeles this year. We know how many barrels of corn or wheat there are in Iowa right now, right? What we did not keep track of was fatal use of force by police officers. There was no comprehensive statistics on this. In fact, the projects that had the best bet of how many people were being killed were basically completely crowdfunded, anonymous websites that were trying to track police killings. And so we looked at each other and we just thought that was something that perhaps we could help with, right? That in order to have a conversation about police use of force, about whether or not police shootings are happening too often and under what circumstance they're happening, that we needed to assemble the information to answer those questions. And so what we began doing in 2015 was attempting to track every on-duty shooting by a police officer, every fatal on-duty shooting by a police officer, with the idea that how could we even begin to have a policy conversation if we did not know and we did not have access to, you know, real information about how often these deaths were occurring.
The FBI wasn't keeping this information, the Department of Homeland Security. I mean, there was no government agency federal on the federal level that was keeping these statistics either. And from what I understand, there was a great reluctance on the part of many local police jurisdictions to keep track of this information and provide the information to either another government agency or the press. I mean, how did you get this information? Where did you cull it from? Did you rely on police departments?
So you're correct that there's a hesitance and that there's not comprehensive data being kept at a national or federal level. There is a number the FBI puts out every year that is based on voluntary self-reporting from departments. According to that number, there have never been more than 463 fatal police shootings in a year. What we found was 990 of them in 2015. So that number was undercounting by at least half how many fatal shootings were occurring each year. Now, the way we went about doing this, because initially we thought we would do this via records, right? We would records request all the police departments. They'd have to tell us this. But what we realized, one, is that that's kind of untenable. There's not even good record keeping on how many police departments there are in the United States of America. The best guess is it's somewhere between 12 and 19,000 police departments. Depending on who you talk to, they'll give you a different number. And we knew we couldn't send, even if it was 12,000, we knew we couldn't send 12,000 FOIA requests. We'd never be able to keep track of all those things, right? But what we realized was that when someone is killed, whether it's in the biggest city or the smallest town, someone is shot and killed by a police officer, for the most part, at least one time, one media outlet writes about it. It's one midday reporter standing next to the crime scene tape doing a stand-up, or one newspaper crime reporter writes a brief, that it creates some type of online record. And so what we began doing is we began combing and searching every day for any additional reports of a fatal on-duty shooting. And once we knew it existed, we could then go back to the department in real time and begin asking questions and confirming the details. And so that's kind of how we went about doing this. Every single day, you know, it's really my colleagues, Julie Tate and Jennifer Jenkins, who were the driving forces behind this part of the work, every single day checking and seeing what do we know, what's here, what have we figured out. And I just think that it was a really, it was a very laborious process. But it helped us in real time get to see how often these shootings were occurring.
And of these shootings that you're recording, 990 in 2015, 963 in 2016, these are not all unarmed black suspects. How do they break down? I mean, some of these are white, some of these are people who are stopped for a traffic stop, others are people who are encountered in the course of a crime, right? I mean, this includes anybody who has been who's been killed by police in the line of duty.
Yes, yes. It includes all of the shootings. I mean, because that was, because again, we wanted to understand the entire universe as a means of beginning to drill into it. Now, what we saw was that the majority of people who were killed by the police are white, which is unsurprising. The majority of people in the United States are white. The majority, vast majority are men, although the vast majority of people who interact with the police are men. What we ended up finding statistically is that while black Americans make up about 12% of the population, they make up roughly 24% of the fatal police shootings, and they make up 40% of the unarmed people who are shot and killed by the police. And so we did find a racial disparity in terms of who is being killed and under what circumstances. In totality, one in three people, or about three people a day, are shot and killed by the police. Every 10 days, it's an unarmed black person. So again, the vast majority of the people killed by the police are not unarmed, and the vast majority of the people killed by the police are not black. But when you start looking at what black people are killed by the police and under what circumstances, you see that black men and women are overrepresented in how often they are killed, and that they are far more often than white people to be killed while they are unarmed.
You also note that one in 10 of these encounters begin with something as putatively innocuous as a traffic stop.
Yes. These shootings cannot be explained away by saying that these are all violent criminals, right? The majority of people being killed by the police, shot and killed by the police, are not murderers or not rapists. There is a wide spectrum of who's being killed. Now, there are certainly bank robbers in our database. There are murderers in our database. But there are also people whose crime is running a red light or maybe running a red light, you know, and because it's based only on the account of the officer. The most common circumstance to lead to a fatal police shooting is a domestic dispute of some sort, some type of domestic incident. These are things that police often know about their profession, but that there's assumptions in the public about who the police are interacting with and why. That if you are involved with a police officer, it must be because you're some type of violent criminal, when in reality, that's often not the case.
You also write that you can speculate that between 2004 and 2014, those 10 years, there were likely 10,000 fatal shootings by on-duty police. And again, because the record-keeping wasn't done in the way you're doing it now, that has to be an estimate. But of those perhaps 10,000 or so fatal shooting incidents, 54 officers were charged with a crime. And of those 54, just a handful were convicted. So to this day, I mean, it is very rare still for a police officer to be indicted and convicted. Has it gotten any less rare as we go into the, you know, to 2017?
We've not seen police shootings get much, if at all, less rare. You know, so we saw 960 or so last year, down from 990 the year before, but we're currently in place this year to be back somewhere between 960 and 990. We don't know yet because we have such little data which of those might be the outlier, which one might be more normal. But again, there's not even a statistically significant difference between 960 of something and 990 of something. What we saw, though, and you note, the prosecutions are exceedingly rare, right? We do not know exactly how many people were killed by the police in the 10 years prior to Ferguson. If we assume the pacing was similar to what it is currently, that about 1,000 people are shot and killed, we can assume that over a 10-year period, there'd probably be about 10,000. Now, what we found, this is really great work by my colleagues, Kimberly O'Kelly and Kimberly Kindy, was that there were just 54 cases during those years in which an officer was charged in an on-duty shooting, that less than one half of 1% of the time an officer is charged. Now, we did see an uptick post-Ferguson. In 2015, there were 18 officers charged, while on average before there had been about 5 officers a year charged. Last year, there were somewhere between 13 and 15 officers charged. So there was a significant uptick. However, as a percentage of the whole, the uptick wasn't that significant. There's still less than 1% of the cases where an officer is being charged.
Wesley Lowery is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The Washington Post who covers law enforcement and justice. His book is called They Can't Kill Us All: Ferguson, Baltimore, and the New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. He joins us on the line from the newsroom of The Washington Post. You're listening to a special edition of Midday. We're not taking any calls today, but you are welcome to post comments on the topic of police violence, accountability, and reform on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be back after a quick break. Stay with us. back. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, it's a midday special edition. We're talking today about police violence. My guest is the journalist and author Wesley Lowery. He was part of a team at the Washington Post that won a Pulitzer Prize for their coverage of Ferguson and other cities where African Americans have been killed by police. His recent book draws on his reporting. It's called They Can't Kill Us All: Ferguson, Baltimore, and the New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. He joins us from the newsroom of the Washington Post. We're not taking calls and emails in this hour, but you are welcome to post comments on the WYPR Facebook page. And by the way, as always, you can hear this conversation and all of our midday shows on our website, wypr.org/midday. So, Wesley Lowery, you went to Ferguson as the first of many places you went and reported on this issue, and you had your own run-in with the police in Ferguson not long after you arrived. Tell us about that.
Of course. And so myself and another reporter, Ryan Riley of the Huffington Post, were two of dozens of reporters who ended up being arrested or detained in Ferguson, Missouri. Now, we were the first two. We were arrested on August 13th, 2014, so 4 days after Michael Brown had been killed. We were taken into custody while we were working in a McDonald's restaurant not far from the protest that the officers came into and decided they wanted to clear. They wanted everyone out, and they got frustrated when they didn't think we were packing our bags quickly enough. They decided that rather than wait a minute, they were going to take us into custody. You know, it became a bit of a firestorm and a media storm. This was something that, you know, again, this was the first time reporters had been taken into custody. And, you know, now there had been hundreds of residents and protesters and activists who had been arrested. But now all of a sudden there seemed to be this willingness to treat the media with the same type of contempt or with this kind of, kind of unpredictable enforcement strategy. And I think that was something that really made a lot of people pay attention to this story who otherwise maybe were not. You know, it blew up and became this large issue. Eric Holder weighed in, time President Obama weighed in, arguing that, you know, journalists should not be being arrested in the course of doing their jobs, that First Amendment protections had to be honored and respected. You know, this ended up being a saga because the county government there decided to, a year later, charge us with a crime after having been arrested. And so then we had to enter into basically a negotiation with them to get them to drop the charges. And so, you know, it was in many ways a frustrating distraction from reporting. You know, you never want to be inserted into the story yourself. It was even just frustrating that night because it was a very eventful night. There was some pretty intense tear gassing. Antonio French, a local city councilman and alderman in St. Louis, was arrested that night, and he had been kind of a prominent figure. And instead of covering those things and writing about them, we're stuck in a jail cell somewhere trying to figure out how to get out. And so that was frustrating. And we also became political footballs in a way. You know, we had kind of talking heads talking about how we were the problem, or we'd gotten ourselves arrested on purpose so we could get on TV, or, you know, that type of bad punditry. But in many ways, it also opened a lot of reporting doors that were interesting, you know, that many of the people who at this point are becoming very skeptical of the media, who are camped out in their homes, many of the people now saw us and they could see, one, they knew who you were because they'd seen us on TV, they'd seen that we'd been arrested or taken into custody. But they also said, you know, look, these people are kind of, they're like us. They've had an interaction with the police. The police have mistreated them. Maybe I'll trust them to tell my story. And so for sourcing purposes, it was extremely helpful because people said, oh, you had a run-in with the Ferguson police too. Let me tell you about mine. And so in many ways, it really kind of helped ingratiate us to the community that we were charged with covering.
On 88.1 WYPR, I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to a midday special edition. My guest today, Wesley Lowery. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of a book called They Can't Kill Us All: Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Wesley Lowery, you talk in the book about what makes the perfect victim, because Mike Brown was just the first of several victims whose families you got to know and whose backstories you got to know and report on very, very completely and very compellingly. Mike Brown had been involved in an altercation involving a theft from a local liquor store a few moments before he was apprehended by Officer Wilson. Other victims that you covered, you know, you mentioned, you know, get stopped for traffic violations or a brake light being out or something like that. You asked that question, you know, what makes for the perfect victim? What answer have you come up with?
Well, I think that because there's a question, and I remember there being an insistence at the time, people who were yelling back at the demonstrators or the protesters, the young activists and the young groups, and they were saying, why rally around this case? And then they would say that about the next one. Why this one? Didn't that person have it coming? Didn't they deserve it? And it began to tear at this kind of fundamental question of who deserves advocacy and who deserves justice? Does everyone deserve justice? And that when someone is killed by the police, to whom do you apply the pressure? Do you interrogate and scrutinize the dead teenager in the street, or do you interrogate and scrutinize the powerful man carrying a gun paid for by the taxpayers and using bullets paid for by the taxpayers who has killed a taxpayer? You know, there was a thought process at many points in the civil rights movement and other social movements that having a martyr or a victim who was in any way imperfect would become so distracting because people would be able to avoid grappling with the question by attacking and impugning the character of the person. It's the reason why we know Rosa Parks' name, even though she was far from the first person to sit down in the back of a bus. She was someone who was unimpeachable, and so they made her the symbol. You know, even in what would have otherwise been remarkably sympathetic cases, you think of Emmett Till and others, there was an effort by many to say, well, Emmett Till must have been older than he appeared, or he must have been had sexual prowess and known things, and there was all of these implications and suggestions to try to demonize the person who'd been killed. We see this after almost every police shooting. We have a litigation of the background and the details of the person who's been dead. And again, this isn't just police shootings. It's also when other men of color are killed. We've seen Trayvon Martin's report cards and read his tweets. People are trying to interrogate and figure out what kind of music does he listen to and is he violent and in many ways, it's a means of a character assassination, of putting the dead child on trial rather than that of the officer. But I think that what was fascinating about this moment in time, these last few years, the protest movement we've seen, has been that it's not about, it has never been about, for many of these young people, the idea of sanitizing their victims. That the idea was always that Michael Brown deserved justice and that his life mattered, whether he was perfect or imperfect, that Tamir Rice or John Crawford or Sandra Bland or Eric Gardner, they all deserved this level of justice, that Black Lives Matter and the movement for Black Lives broadly was not going to focus only on perfect victims, because focus only on perfect victims is in many ways a means of allowing the state to abdicate its responsibilities.
And you write that in the early days, people were in fact, the media were in fact litigating Michael Brown, not the shooting, and that the incident itself really didn't get covered nationally, but it was the response to the shooting and the response to the militaristic impulse and response of the local police department in Ferguson that really got people upset. And you talk about the role of reporters, and you in particular talk about the role of reporters in so-called legacy media. Out-of-town reporters coming into towns like Ferguson and having a certain arrogance about their ability to tell the story that local journalists might not be able to do. And you say that there's a fundamental arrogance in assessing the role of the media in the creation of social movements. I'm interested by that. I mean, obviously, what happened in Ferguson did set off, it was the impetus and the animation of Black Lives Matter and other movements related to things not just about police shootings, but Confederate imagery and you write about respectability politics, cultural appropriation. All these things happened after Ferguson. What is the role of the legacy media in perpetuating this instinct to litigate the victims along with anything else that's going on in the story?
You know, I think that there's interesting dynamics here, right? One, the media, those of us in the media, certainly have an an inclination sometimes to make ourselves parts of the story, and we can be a little self-important at times. And so we I think at times can think that we're playing a role that's much larger, right? The reason we know of Michael Brown's name is not because of media coverage, it's because of the people of Ferguson sending tweets, right? It wasn't because we showed up. But I do think, is what's interesting now, 3 years out, is how little conversation we've ever had nationally about the actual specific policing tactics of the interaction between Darren Wilson and Michael Brown, about the decision of Darren Wilson to get out of the car, the decision of Darren Wilson to even pull his gun while he is seated in a car. You know, that so much of our conversation has been specifically about one action or lack of action by Michael Brown. Did he put his hands up and surrender, or did he not? When in reality, that is not the crucial moment in this interaction, one way or the other, right? And so I think that, you know, part of that is that we, in a absence of information, that void is always filled. That in those early days, there was so little information coming from the Ferguson police that that void was filled with a lot of information, some of it bad information. And that so then so much of the media narrative ended up being about trying to litigate whether or not the story that people believed to be true was true or not, without actually seeking to answer the question of what really happened. But beyond that, I do think that we create a false equivalency when we start to gauge the behaviors of police officers, people who are sworn to serve and protect us and the Constitution, our constitutional rights as residents, with that of residents who do not have the same obligations, right? At the end of the day, I know much more about Michael Brown than I know about Darren Wilson. Now, Darren Wilson, again, was paid by the taxpayers, carrying a gun paid for by the taxpayers, had a paid leave paid for by the taxpayers, right? And killed a taxpayer using a bullet paid for by the taxpayers. I think that there has to be a different level of accountability and a different level of questioning, right? I think it's our job in the media to apply pressure to powerful people. And again, when a teenager's been killed in the street, the powerful person there is not the dead teenager in the street. It's the person holding the smoking gun.
You also write about, you know, why did it take, for example, in the civil rights movement in the 60s, why did it take white reporters writing for a white audience to change what black people had known for decades, for generations?
Well, and I think there's a question of how... We definitely know the media coverage played a role, but and I think in part it was because the power structures were controlled by white Americans, right? I have no evidence that Lyndon B. Johnson was reading the Chicago Defender or was routinely talking to black people who, you know, we know, in fact, you know, that when the Kennedys met with Baldwin, it was perhaps the first time they'd really spent any significant amount of time even talking to a prominent black person, engaging them, right? That in many ways it took these white messengers, because otherwise white Americans and white powerful Americans, because what we have to remember also is that in the civil rights movement, public opinion was never on the side of the protest or the demonstrations. It was never on the side of Martin Luther King or in Montgomery, the bus boycotters on SNCC or the Freedom Rides. In fact, most Americans thought these things were harmful and disruptive and didn't like them. But the pressure, rather, was applied to the powerful. And it created this moment of crisis, this idea that this needs to be changed because we can't have people getting bit by dogs in the streets and fire hoses. Someone's going to get killed. More people are going to get killed. We have to stop this. And if the way to stop this is to give them what they want, give it to them. It's the idea that you're not necessarily appealing to people's hearts and minds, but rather you're appealing to people's sense of order. If you can create disorder, people on both sides of the issue will want to return you to a state of order. I think that's something that is extremely, that we overlook and don't think about sometimes. Now, in this case, in the case of the protests we've seen in the last 2 years, 3 years, we're seeing stories that have been told for generations by black and brown Americans. People who say and have said that the police behave with impunity around them, that they're being shot in the back, they're having weapons planted on them, they're being profiled and harassed. Black Americans have told this story forever. And some mainstream media organizations have helped tell that story sometimes, not always, sometimes. But what was different about this moment was that because of social media and because of the cellular telephone, the people of Ferguson or the people of Baltimore, or people of Charlotte or Milwaukee, New York, didn't need the media to tell the story. They could tell the story themselves. They could take their phones out, they could take pictures, they could send tweets, and that the compelling content they were producing was what propelled the story forward, not some decision by the mainstream media. I think that's a crucial distinction between some of the history and the moment we've been in now.
So you write that, you know, the legacy media often thinks that, you know, it was responsible for the success of the civil rights movement. And one of the reasons is because it didn't validate and trust the black experience. Has that changed because of social media, because of the so-called citizen journalists who are taking the video, posting things to Facebook, getting stuff out there over the heads or at least around the corner of the media? Do you see that changing, and is it changing the attitude of your editors and the people in the legacy media in terms of how these stories need to be covered?
In some cases. But I think even beyond changing the attitudes and the minds, it's removing the choice. If everyone on the internet today is talking about this thing, we have to write about it. It's democratized news in a way that news had not been democratized previously. That all of a sudden, if everyone's talking about a police shooting, well, why haven't we covered it? Everyone else is. Everyone else is talking about it. Shouldn't we be on this thing? It was a means of forcing the media to pay attention to storylines we otherwise might have ignored.
You write about the black leadership in Ferguson when you were reporting there, saying that this was a volcano destined to erupt and things really weren't going to change until white leaders quit picking black leaders. There was a lot of ink spilled about the number of black citizens in this majority black suburb of St. Louis who didn't vote, the small number of legislative representatives they had on the town council, the city council. What's the political situation like in Ferguson now? Are you aware that it has changed in any dramatic way since the death of Michael Brown in 2014?
Well, there have been more people of color elected to their council. By that I mean any people of color, essentially. I think there are two currently on their council, so still relatively unrepresentative of their city at large, but more representation. I think there's been some hiring of the police department as well, and the current police chief, I believe, is a black man. But as is also, I mean, it's interesting because very recently there's been an election in St. Louis, city of St. Louis, a Democratic primary in their mayoral race, in which yet another, white front runner has won the Democratic primary and is likely going to be the next mayor of the city of St. Louis, in a city that is far majority black and had black candidates in the race. And there's this question of whether or not the black vote was diluted and divided through multiple candidates. But the reality is, it's not just about representational leadership. I actually think that, and one thing I talk about in the book is, I think that there, one of the reasons we had this moment, that 2014 was the time when this happened, it's not just because of cell phone videos, although that's part of it. It's not because there were more police shootings, because I don't think that is true. We don't know, but I don't think that's true. What was also true is that black Americans, who for generations had been told that you show up to vote and you play this representational political game, had been given a black president. They had elected a black president. And then they watched as these shootings continued. I remember talking to activists who would say, you know, I voted for Obama twice and Trayvon Martin's still dead. I voted for Barack Obama twice and Michael Brown's still dead. That what this rash of shootings going viral showed us was the limitations of a black presidency and the limitations of representational politics. And that people who show up in the streets to protest are not doing so because they refuse to otherwise engage in the system, but they often do it rather because they have otherwise engaged in the system and it has not served them.
Wesley Lowery, his book is called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and the New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. You're listening to a special edition of Midday here on 88.1 WIPR. Our conversation is recorded today, so we're not taking calls or emails, but you are welcome to leave comments on the WIPR Facebook page. More with Wesley Lowery when we return after this quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Stick around. Welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, you're listening to a Midday special edition. At the age of 25, Wesley Lowery and a team from the Washington Post won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting for their coverage of protests in Ferguson following the shooting of Michael Brown by police officer Darren Wilson. Lowry went on to cover shootings and protests in Baltimore and elsewhere, and he's compiled his reflections on that work in a book released in 2016 called They Can't Kill Us All: Ferguson, Baltimore, and the New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. Wesley Lowry joins me to talk about police violence, an issue, of course, that has most certainly been front of mind here in Baltimore. A damning report on the Baltimore Police Department by the Department of Justice in August of 2016 resulted in a consent decree that requires increased training and substantial reforms in other areas. We've recorded our conversation today, so we can't take your calls and emails, but we welcome your feedback and insights on this discussion. We invite you to weigh in on the WYPR Facebook page. So, Wesley Lowry, let's talk a little bit about Baltimore. African Americans are arrested per capita more than three times the rate of other races here in our city. We've had a long history of police misconduct. Because you were covering this as a beat, when you got to Baltimore after the death of Freddie Gray and the uprising that occurred, did you see a lot of parallels as you think about the totality of all the different cities you write about in the book? Are there some common threads that run through all of them?
When Michael Brown was first killed and the media coverage first started, there was this inclination for people to assume that Ferguson must just be different, that what was happening here could not happen anywhere else. This must be some crazy backwater town full of racists, and this could never happen where I live. And in fact, after shooting, what we would see elected officials say so often was, well, we're no Ferguson. They'd say this all the time. As their city was burning, they would say, well, we're no Ferguson. The reality is the story of Ferguson is the story of America, that in so many cases, the themes that we saw there are transferable in so many in most other places. Those themes are poverty, they're housing redlining, they're segregation, both of schools and residences. It was funny. I remember walking with a reporter in Baltimore. This would have been a few days after the Freddie Gray's funeral, which prompted the first set of kind of riots or unrest. And I remember walking, and he was making fun of some of the international reporters who were taking pictures in West Baltimore of buildings that had always been, had always been vacant, and thinking that this had been because of the rioting. Well, look at this building that's now boarded up.
Yeah, it was boarded up since 1968 in those riots.
Yeah. Exactly, right? Yeah, yeah. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to get down to some of these neighborhoods, look around, talk to people, and say, well, it seems like life's pretty grim here, that clearly something about the system has not worked. And it's not far beyond that to start thinking and realizing, well, okay, if this is the reality, people are living in this, how must they feel now that they've watched on tape someone being killed in this neighborhood, feeling like they're not going to get any justice, right? I think that there is, I think that there's just a similar, in so many of our cities, a similar set of concerns and issues. These are not specific. I mean, and now they're specific in many ways to the city. You know, Baltimore might have the problem in one way, while Ferguson has it in a little bit of a different way. There's certainly local context, but the reality is that it's linked to the story of Black America more broadly.
The one possible exception that you wonder about in your book is the people who were at a prayer meeting at Emmanuel Church in Charleston. And you say that some people argue that the Charleston Nine, who were slaughtered by an avowed racist named Dylan Roof, should be that incident should be viewed in isolation. And others say that that incident is undeniably linked to Freddie Gray, Mike Brown, Eric Garner, Walter Scott, etc. Have you come to any conclusion in your own mind about that?
Some might argue that Dylan Roof is a one-off terrorist, that he's an outlier. He's not representative of anything else. What most Black and Brown Americans would argue, and what I probably would argue as well, is that Clementa Pinckney, the Reverend, as well as the other eight people murdered in Mother Emanuel AME Church, were killed because of the scent of their brown skin. That what determined whether they lived or died in America was the pigment in their skin. Now, that's not far when you start to consider many of these other cases. When you talk about Trayvon Martin, what is it that made him seem like such a threat to George Zimmerman? When you think about Jordan Davis, what made him seem to be such a threat to Michael Dunn? You think about Tamir Rice or John Crawford or Michael Brown, why were they seen as someone who needed to be dealt with lethal force? Now, the specific circumstances certainly factor in, but the reality is none of those people did things that we have not seen on video white men and white women doing as well. It raises the question in the minds of Black Americans, did the skin color of this person not factor into their death? It raises this wonder about what in 2017 remains the threat of black skin, that there seems to be circumstances in which a white American could navigate, could make mistakes, could be imprudent or rude or offensive, yet that would not equal a death sentence for them. And it seems that in many of those cases, black Americans are being dealt death sentences without judge or jury, without trial, without an attorney, in the street of Ferguson, Missouri, in the street of Baltimore. I think that is, you know, again, I think it speaks to, you know, we live in a society in which we constructed a world where black skin was devalued since our inception as a nation. And the question we grapple with still, in the 60s, they used to call it the Negro problem, right? The question we grapple with is still, to what extent are we still defined by the delineations we have chosen to make as a society between black and white?
Wesley Lowery, his book is called They Can't Kill Us All, Ferguson, Baltimore, and a New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to a Midday Special Edition. When you're on the ground reporting about this, where do you see the zeitgeist about equivalency between the shootings of police versus the shootings of often unarmed suspects?
I think that one of the major thematics here is the concept of order. We live in a society, we live in a world that values things being orderly. The bus is running on time, traffic lights and people following them, people complying with police officers, people not blocking your highway on your way to work this morning, right? That we value that, we crave that, and we in fact have structured a system in order to ensure order more broadly. And I think one of the things that frustrates people about protests is that it brings disorder and chaos into their otherwise orderly life. Now, some might argue that is the point of protests. But what's interesting is that questioning of the police fundamentally means questioning of that order. The police are the extension of the system of order. They are the ones enforcing the order. And so to question them, whether it be their motives or their actions, is to question the entirety of that system. It's unsurprising to me that that prompts a backlash, but what's also unsurprising to me is that many white Americans specifically, have a deep barrier preventing them from empathizing with the experiences of black and brown Americans. For most white Americans, the police are someone who you call when you are in trouble, when you've locked your keys in your car, when your cat is in a tree, when your mother is sick. For most black and brown Americans, the police are an oppressive force who they see as harassing them and interacting with them in ways that could lead to them being dead. Those two prisms, those glasses, those views through which these different groups of people see the police determine whether you are inclined to give weight to skepticism of those police or if you are inclined to instinctively and reactively defend those police. And I think that's what we're seeing, is that we still live in a country where the majority of people are inclined to cling to that order and to defend the police rather than to invite scrutiny of the police. I think I see a lot of that. Now, there is a real concern, both in police circles and broadly, about violence against police officers. The question becomes, because everyone I've heard condemns that type of violence, the question becomes, how do you go about rectifying it? If you're a chain of circumstances that you have people who feel violated and disrespected and oppressed by police, and they are speaking out about that experience, and that speaking out is causing other people to be so distrustful that they are harming police, do you seek to stop the people from speaking out, or do you seek to rectify the reality that these people feel oppressed and are being hurt? I think that is the fundamental tension between these kind of sea of blue Lives Matter rallies and the Black Lives Matter rallies.
With Black Lives Matter, as we finish up here, and with figures like DeRay McKesson, whom folks here in Maryland and in Baltimore know pretty well, he ran for mayor, And when I've talked to DeRay, he's expressed some reticence about even being identified as a leader of the Black Lives Matter movement, because that movement, they pride themselves on being leaderless and being very close to the grassroots. Do you think the movement is gaining acceptance or gaining more influence and more capacity to inform public policy? What shape would you say the civil rights movement, the Black Lives Matter movement in particular, is in at the moment?
Well, I think they gained significant platform capacity and influence in the years following Ferguson. I think we're now at a pivotal moment because the name of the game has changed with an incoming administration. The very few people who worked in these spaces have experience working when you are not attempting to pressure someone who at the basic levels agrees with you and you're trying to pressure them into doing the right thing. That is how many activists might describe their experiences with the Obama administration, for example, or with the previous Justice Departments, that we're attempting to get the Justice Department to launch an investigation in which we know they will find civil rights violations. We're attempting to get Barack Obama to speak more freely about racial injustices that we know he believes exist, right? That's a very different game than when you're interacting with perhaps current Attorney General Jeff Sessions or the Donald Trump administration, in which you understand that you are now oppositionally situated in a way that you were not previously. You're not trying to convince the Department of Justice to proactively do something they otherwise might be inclined to do. In fact, you're attempting to stop the Department of Justice from doing things that you would disagree with, right? It changes the tactics. I think what's difficult when we have the conversation about kind of national leadership, local leadership, is that in the protest space, in the activism space, there has been a real conscious decision to keep things decentralized, to not have any one great charismatic leader who carries the mantle of whether it be the movement for Black Lives or any of these other social movements, right? But that makes sense in that when you're talking about policing specifically, that's something that's a battle that has to be fought in each of those locations. Each department comes up with their own policies, their own rules, their own hiring, their own standards, right? So you have to fight these battles locally, but it does become difficult at times to show your work nationally because you're fighting this battle on so many fronts. What I'm really fascinated in moving forward is what the movement does more broadly and how it either ingratiates itself while also how it attempts to continue to distinguish itself from the activism more broadly across the center-left coalition, whether that be immigration activism or Muslim activism or LGBTQ activism, right? How does the Black political leadership continue to maintain its own voice, and does it at all? Or does it become a support system of these other movements, and does it await its moment to be back? I don't know what the answer is going to be there.
Wesley Lowery is a national reporter covering police violence and justice for The Washington Post. His book is compelling, upsetting, and poignant. It's called They Can't Kill Us All: Ferguson, Baltimore, and the New Era in America's Racial Justice Movement. It's published by Little Brown. We'll have a link to Fatal Force, the database compiled and updated by the staff of The Washington Post that tracks people around the country killed by police in the line of duty. You can find that link to that, rather, at wipr.org/midday. Well, Wesley Lowery, I really enjoyed the book and really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to a special edition of Midday. You can hear this and any episode of Midday you'd like to check out on our website. Again, the address, wipr.org/midday. We hope you'll subscribe to our podcast and that you'll follow us on Twitter. You can also leave comments on what you've heard on our program on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day.